ADP knows anything you hear, anything you don't hear, anything you kinda heard, anything you weren't supposed to hear and now have to pretend like you didn't, can change the world of work. From HR to payroll, ADP designs forward-thinking solutions to take on the next anything.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
After 2 weeks of impeachment hearings, where do the debate and the evidence stand? We'll offer you our summary of both. Plus, Democratic presidential candidates hold their fifth debate. Did anyone gain politically with the Iowa caucus less than 3 months away? Welcome. I'm Paul Gigot with the Wall Street Journal. And I am here with my colleagues, Kim Strassel. Hello, Kimberly.
Hello, Paul.
And Kyle Peterson. Hi, Kyle.
Hello, hello.
Hello. I forgot your name there for a second.
Sometimes I do, too.
Which is strange because he is not forgettable.
All right. So let's first start with impeachment. We've now had 5 days of impeachment testimony. And over the course of 2 weeks, this is pretty much now the complete case that the Intelligence Committee and Adam Schiff plan to bring on Ukraine, as far as we can tell. There may be other things that are brought to bear when the process moves to the Judiciary Committee after Thanksgiving. But for now, Kim, where do you think the impeachment process stands, not on a chronological basis, but just in terms of the summary of the case? Have the Democrats made the case that Donald Trump committed what you would define as impeachable offenses?
Well, from the reaction of Republicans, and that includes Republicans in the Senate who are going to ultimately probably hold a trial, and in terms of the polling, especially among independents and Republicans, no, they have not. They do not seem to have moved the needle at all. And in fact, if you look at some recent polls, it suggests that people have been moving, again, away from favorability on impeachment, especially among independents, which are a core group here. And I think the problem that Democrats have had is that they had a pretty tenuous case to make in the beginning. This argument that there was a quid pro quo, they've since morphed it into bribery or extortion. But the witnesses that we have had over the past 2 weeks have simply not made that case. They've certainly suggested there was some poor judgment involved in having Rudy Giuliani off freelancing in Ukraine, or the president's decision to mention Joe Biden's name in that call. But in terms of suggesting that there was a legally defensible case for bribery or anything close to it, that they just haven't managed to do that with these witnesses.
Let's break that down a little bit first, just on the public opinion point. There's a new Emerson poll. Emerson's not my favorite poll, but it's a respectable poll, and it says that the support for impeachment has flipped in November since October, from 48% support in October to 45% now. Not a huge flip, but it's, you know, notable. So it was 48 support, 44 no on impeachment in October. Now it's 45 opposed and 43 in support. Even more interesting is the state poll, the Marquette poll in Marquette University poll in Wisconsin. And that is a very good poll, very good track record in Wisconsin. Found that support for impeachment now is at 40%, with 53% no. And that's a flip it's a reduction from October of 44% in favor and 51% against. And of course, Wisconsin being a key swing state. Also, that the head-to-head polling, and granted, it's a long way out between Donald Trump and Joe Biden, has flipped. Trump is now leading in Wisconsin 47-44, and he was trailing a month ago 50-44. So this doesn't look like momentum, Kyle, for impeachment on a political basis.
No, just the opposite. So the one that I have had my eye on is the polling aggregator at 538, which has not quite flipped, but it's about to flip. The high point was 50% in favor of impeachment or an inquiry and 44 against. Now we're about dead even, 46-46. And some of the drops are really striking. So about a month ago, Democrats, 85% said yes. Now we're down to 80. Independents, it was 48% saying yes. Now we're down to 41. That is a significant slide. And I think that reflects, you know, a few things. One of them is that there are still gaps in the impeachment story that the Democrats are trying to tell. The biggest one being that, you know, even Ambassador Sondland, the star witness, Gordon Sondland, who testified this week, says that he doesn't have direct knowledge of why the aid, the military aid to Ukraine, was put on hold. And he surmises that it was related to the investigations that the president wanted into Burisma and, in effect, into Joe Biden and his son. But he doesn't have any direct knowledge of that. I mean, that's a problem. Democrats could try to compel testimony from somebody with more knowledge of that, such as John Bolton or Mick Mulvaney, but they've chosen not to. They've chosen speed over thoroughness here. They want to get this done before, you know, before January, before the primaries, the caucuses start. And that's a problem because it makes the whole thing look political. So the guy who I think has spoken for the way a lot of Republicans feel here is Republican Representative Will Hurd from Texas,
who is retiring at the end of this Congress.
Yes, and is no fan of President Trump. He represents a swing district along the border there. You know, it's a little bit of San Antonio suburbs and then a lot of rural areas. And so he summed it up and said, an impeachable offense should be compelling, overwhelmingly clear, and unambiguous. It is not something to be rushed or taken lightly. I have not heard evidence proving the president committed bribery or extortion. I mean, I think that sums up the way a lot of people feel, even if they think that the president's conduct here was not something they would condone.
So the on the substance, news this week out of the impeachment hearings came from Gordon Sondland, the U.S. ambassador to the EU. And the two big things that certainly the critics or the supporters of impeachment pointed out was that Sondland said that Donald Trump had directed it all, that he was operating with Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal attorney, at the express direction of the president, number one. And I guess my reaction to that is, that's not really news. We knew that. I don't know who, anybody out there who thought that Donald Trump wasn't directing this in the sense that he wanted the Ukraine to investigate Joe Biden and that he was tasking Rudy Giuliani to do it, to help with that. That's number one. Number two is the issue of a quid pro quo. And you mentioned that the Sondland said he presumed there was a quid pro quo, and that's not necessarily decisive evidence of, in fact, there having been so, even though, and we can go on to say whether the quid and the quo were substantial enough to even qualify under the bribery statute. I don't believe they were. But really, we don't have anybody directly saying that Trump told them on the quid pro quo,
well,
Kim.
Yeah, right. And by the way, let's just dig into that for a second, because there are now kind of two quid pro quo that are being mentioned. Remember, we started with the Democratic argument that the quid pro quo was that Ukrainians would not get military aid unless these investigations were announced. And again, Gordon Sondland said that he presumed that that aid was somehow linked to the investigations and the fact that it was held for a while. But then he acknowledged under cross-examination or in his testimony that he had no direct knowledge of that, that no one has ever told him why the aid was withheld. And to this day, he still doesn't know. So there's that. But then Democrats along the way had shifted the goalposts, as it were, and said that, well, the quid pro quo was actually whether or not Vladimir Volodymyr Zelensky would get a meeting with the president, and that that was whether or not would depend on whether or not he opened an investigation. Gordon Sondland said, well, yes, there was a quid pro quo for that. But then again, under further questioning, he acknowledged, well, he just presumed that Donald Trump had in fact never said that to him directly. In fact, during one conversation, Donald Trump had said, I don't want anything in return. There's no quid pro quo. All I want is President Zelensky to do what he campaigned on and do something about corruption. So that kind of fell apart as well. And this is what the kind of mess that Democrats are left with at the end of this week.
Well, yeah, the fact that it's not a clear-cut case, Kyle, that there's some ambiguous contradictory evidence on some of this stuff makes it, and the fact that it is also confused by the fog of diplomacy and what a president does with other countries. I mean, none of this is anything that I think makes Trump look good. I think that he was clearly questioning his own policy, undermining his own stated policy of support for Ukraine. Most of his administration knew about this. They opposed their own president on it, and they fought back and tried to persuade him not to change the policy. And it's an illustration, in my view, of Trump's often bad impulses on policy. He indulges a personal bias in the case of Ukraine, a little maybe perhaps motivated by his sense of wanting to get back at Ukraine for what he thought was their meddling in the 26 campaign for Hillary Clinton. But it's bad form, it's bad policy, bad judgment. But you're going to remove a president for this is the question that the Democrats have put on the table with impeachment. I don't see it.
And also the president's contradictory impulses. I mean, I think it was Sondland who said, you know, he wants one thing one day, he wants another thing another day. They're trying to figure out how to push American policy forward here. I mean, the letter from Senator Ron Johnson that we talked about a few days ago, laying out his experience, also helps muddy the waters here, because he says the president has always been skeptical of this aid to Ukraine. So that's another thing to think about. And then there's also the prudential case. If you're an independent voter or, you know, a moderate Democrat or a moderate Republican, and you're thinking, you know, are we really going to, like you said, remove the president for this, but also remove the president for this, you know, a week or a month before the Iowa caucuses in the middle of a presidential election. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of factors that go into it, but clearly, just looking at the polling, Democrats haven't made the case. And as we've said before, in a saner political culture, the president would step back and say, you know, sorry, I understand why I shouldn't have done that. And Democrats would say, you know, maybe we'll censure you or pursue some oversight and see if we can get testimony from John Bolton and find the smoking gun that we don't have right now. But everybody's just run into their corners.
We're talking about impeachment and the Democratic presidential race, and you're listening to Potomac Watch from The Wall Street Journal.
The Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin. Investment professionals reveal their best mentors, how they find their next great idea, and a few funny stories. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
From the opinion pages of The Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot with Kyle Peterson and Kim Strassel. And talking about impeachment and where do we go from here? The Thanksgiving holiday for Congress beckons. They'll be back in the first week of December. And when they are back, I guess this moves now to the Judiciary Committee. We'll see if the Intelligence Committee calls any more witnesses. Right now, they have no announced plans to. The charge under the resolution of impeachment was for the Democrats on the Intelligence Committee to put together a memo summarizing the evidence, send it over to Judiciary, and that would serve as the basis for articles of impeachment. It looks like right now that they're putting together one charge of bribery, maybe another charge of extortion. We'll see what form that takes. And then maybe a charge of obstruction of justice for resisting obstruction of Congress for resisting Congress's attempt to call John Bolton and his former NSC advisor and his former deputy Charlie Kupperman, among others, to testify. The president has said he has barred their testimony under national security privilege and presidential advisor privilege. And Democrats originally subpoenaed Kupperman, but they withdrew that subpoena after it went to court. They've now asked the court to stop the case, and Judge Dick Leon said, "No, I'm gonna have a ruling on this." But the Democrats, as you said, Kyle, want to go forward. They don't want fast. They don't want to play this out. So I guess we're going to are they going to get an impeachment impeachment articles in the first week of December? I guess we are.
That would be my guess. And the question is, whether the big question is how many Democrats are going to vote for it or defect. I mean, it seems likely that they'll pass that. But it remains to be seen how broad the impeachment articles are going to be, too. I mean, there's been some talk of, maybe we can throw some of the Bob Mueller report stuff in there. And I mean, that question could also determine how partisan this is perceived as, too. Because one of the Republican complaints and grievances is that they've been a lot of these members of the House have been talking about impeaching the president from essentially day one. And so if they do some broad articles that include some of that stuff, they may be more at risk of losing a few of these swing district Democrats.
Kim, let's shift to the Democratic presidential candidates. We had the debate this week. Was there anybody in your view who stood out and helped themselves in a significant fashion?
Yeah, I think that what we saw was a theme stood out, and that was that you saw some of the less radical, less progressive members on the stage really stand up and make an argument for a little bit more moderation in Democratic policies. And I think a couple people in that regard stood out. Joe Biden was there doing it. I wouldn't say that he had a kind of runaway debate evening. Overall, the debate was kind of boring. Amy Klobuchar, she made some very strong points about the need to be fiscally sound for Democrats to be able to pay for the programs that they propose. You had Cory Booker, too, who I had really great back and forth in my mind with Elizabeth Warren about her wealth tax and his making the case. He said, look, we as Democrats, we need to promote a more fair and just taxation system, but we need to be talking about economic growth too and an opportunity for people to grow their wealth. And that's an important point for us to get back to. So I think there were some really good arguments that were made for the party to maybe come back to a few more of the things that a lot more Americans in the middle care about.
Kyle, from my own observations, better or worse, I thought Joe Biden did reasonably well. He had the familiar stumbles that he has had throughout this cycle in the debates, but nothing egregious. And I thought he put on a forceful case, made it a coherent case against the political problems of Medicare for All, not as thoroughgoing as I know you would have made, but nonetheless, pretty good for a Democratic debate. And he sounded really good, I thought, on foreign policy. And that's one of the things that I think really opened up in this debate, is that Donald Trump has some vulnerability on foreign policy. His support for some dictators, rhetorical support, Kim Jong-un, Xi Jinping, and his failure to speak up for democracy and freedom in some of these places is going to be a particular, attack line for Democrats. And then some of the national security interests and back and the, as Gordon Sondland put it, he's the inconsistency, the changeability of his point of view.
I would agree with that. I think that the erratic nature of the relationship with Kim Jong-un in North Korea is probably going to be a serious matter of debate next year. As far as Biden goes, I agree. I think he did well. What strikes me about him as distinguishing is that he talks about America in a positive way. You know, it's not carnage, and you know, we're doing okay. I mean, I was struck by his closing statement. He says, Biden says, "I'm so tired of everybody walking around like, woe is me. What are we going to do? Let's remember this is the United States of America." And that's not the kind of stuff that that plays well to the Twitter crowd that's very interested in the detailed policy. But I can see, you know, Democrats at home, you know, in the Midwest or whatever, watching their TVs and really taking a liking to that kind of talk. As far as the rest of the debate goes, I mean, what struck me most was how many instances of candidates there were who declined to really pointedly attack their rivals. I mean, Pete Buttigieg is the rising candidate in Iowa and New Hampshire. Nobody really went after his record in South Bend or his non-moderate policies. I know he's pitching himself to the middle lane, but he's a little bit to the left of that sometimes, and nobody really went after that. Nobody really went after Elizabeth Warren for saying that now that she's going to do Medicare for All in year three, which is an admission for anybody who knows politics is that she's not really going to do it. And I, you know, I think we've hit the point of diminishing returns here on some of these debates. The debate audience was about 6.5 million viewers reportedly. That's down from about 18 million for one of the first debates. And so people, you know, people are starting to make up their minds and don't need to hear again and again some of these talking points.
Well, but are they really making up their mind? Some of them are shifting their minds. I mean, Elizabeth Warren has dropped a bit, and Pete Buttigieg has risen a bit. Biden seems to have stabilized. But I think overall, the race still strikes me as fluid, Kim, in the sense that even though the top four, that's Biden, Sanders, Warren, and Buttigieg, have been pretty consistent for a while, seems to me that there's still potential room to for somebody else to break out if one of them, if Biden in particular, stumbles, or if voters look at Mayor Pete and say he's still not he's still too young for the job.
Oh, absolutely. And this is what was notable to me about the debate this week was that if you looked at those front runners, and I think this is a kind of touches on what Kyle was saying about nobody going after each other. Those front runners understand that the biggest risk to them right now is making a mistake, making an unforced error that then puts them out of the running. And so everyone was playing it safe, as it were, on the stage that night, especially those front runners, not going after each other, not doing anything that could court criticism, and instead speaking very much about their own positive agenda. But look, we know from the history of these primaries, things can remain very, very fluid. Look what has happened with Buttigieg just in the past couple of weeks and these latest polls in Iowa and New Hampshire. So, you know, to me, I think the interesting question is who takes votes away from each other at whose expense, and also when we get a few more of these people who start to drop out, because, you know, folks like Cory Booker, even if someone like Amy Klobuchar, you know, money's tight, and how long can you go on? And then when you get out, and it's only a few percentage here or there, but someone's going to be able to capitalize on that.
Well, and as the caucus gets closer, there will be a greater focus of attention because people will have to make up their minds, and there'll be more concentration of time and effort on the ground and over the airwaves in Iowa, which will begin to make a difference and maybe make these national debates less salient. All right. Thank you, Kim. Thank you, Kyle. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back next week. Thanksgiving week with more editions of Potomac Watch.
This episode is brought to you by Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington can affect your portfolio every day, but what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab that unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and portfolio. Listen at schwab.com/washingtonwise.